So it's a very exciting project to enter into the study of Tanya. It's a book like no other. And I remember when I first studied Tanya, I was quite, I guess, confused for a while, trying to understand what actually is this book about. You know, every book is about something. What is this one about? What's its topic? You know, in Torah literature, we have books that are like a commentary on the Chumash, on the Parasha of the Week. We have Talmudic works and the commentaries on the Talmud. We have halachic works, Jewish law, philosophical works that talk about different spiritual ideas and metaphysical concepts, mystical, Kabbalistic works. There's all different types of genres of books, and their topic is clear what it's about. Usually, you'll see on the title page what this book is about. Tanya doesn't fit into any of those categories. It includes all of them, but doesn't really fit into any of them. And it took me a while to really realize what the book is about is me. This is a book about me. It's describing me. It's talking about my soul, my inner workings, the way my brain and heart work, what is going on inside of me, the inner struggles. It's explaining to me, and what's happening. What is my mission? What is my purpose? And how do I fulfill it? And until I realized that, I don't think I started to appreciate Tanya. And as soon as I realized that, it became a totally different book. Because I'm not studying a topic outside. I'm actually finding out who I am. That's what Tanya does in the most incredible way. And so the experience of studying Tanya in that way, when you really start to apply it to yourself and find yourself in it, is a very rewarding one, an enriching one. It changes your life, as it has for many, many hundreds and thousands of people since it was first written. So I thought the best way to start Tanya is from indeed the beginning, or in fact before the beginning, the title page. The first edition of Tanya was in around 1770, was when it was published. In the lifetime of its author, Rabbi Schneur Zalman, who's known as the Alter Rebbe. He's the founder of Chabad. He's the first Rebbe of the Chabad movement. He wasn't in Lubavitch. Lubavitch is the village where his son moved, and the movement then became known as Lubavitch from that village. But he didn't live there. He lived in a town called Liadi at the time he wrote the Tanya. Also Liozhna, another town, all in White Russia. And but he was known as Rabbi Schneur Zalman of Liadi. In Chabad circles, he's known as the Alter Rebbe, the old Rebbe, the first Rebbe. Okay, he's the founder of the Chabad movement. And Chabad was the name of the movement from its very beginning. Chabad meaning an acronym of the three Hebrew words Chachma, Bina, Daat, which mean wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. We're going to learn in Tanya what those three words really mean. They're talking about three intellectual faculties. And the reason he named his philosophy Chabad is because he attempted to bring the deepest spiritual ideas that are mystical and abstract in a way that your brain can totally understand it. Because once your brain understands something, it becomes relatable, you can internalize it, and it can become a part of you. So he called it Chabad, which means as we're studying, we may encounter some very mystical ideas, but the idea is not to get airy-fairy about mysticism, but it's actually to understand it and to be able to internalize it and apply it. That's the idea.
Also, like the last one, this one, what are you going to say? So you were too young.
So there are many different ways of learning Tanya. The way I want to learn it is a very applied way of learning it. In other words, not to study it as an interesting philosophy or theory, but to look at it the way the author intended, as a life-changing experience, something that you study and internalize and relate to and bring it down. And I think we'll see that the Tanya has the power to do that, to transform our way of thinking and therefore the way we live. But I don't want it to be my words, I want it to be the Alter Rebbe's words. So I'm going to get straight into it. And the sheet that I've given you is the title page of Tanya. Now, often the title pages in books are written by publishers or others. Here, the author himself wrote his title page with the description of the book, of his own book. And in these few lines, he sets the tone for the entire book of Tanya. So, as we read it, we'll get a bit of a feel of its author and of what he was trying to achieve in this unique work. So, you've got it in front of you in Hebrew at the top, and it's translated in English at the bottom. So we'll read it. Sefer Likutei Amarim. The Sefer, the book called Likutei Amarim. This is the title he gave his book. We call it Tanya, which we'll discuss why later. He called the book Likutei Amarim, which means a compilation of teachings. Or, more accurately, a compilation of sayings. Likutei Amarim is a compilation of sayings. So this already gives a little bit of an insight into what this book is. He called it a compilation. What's a compilation? What does it mean? A likut? What does that mean?
A collection.
From?
Other writings.
Other places. So it's a compendium, a gathering, a collection of other things.
Other things already existing, but we just collect them.
Correct. Now, that's the first line of the book, and that's what he's called it. When you read the book, it's so innovative, it's so unique and original, that it is hard to see how it's a gathering, a compendium, a collection of other ideas. And people have said that in his humility, he saw it, and he honestly saw it as, I studied, and from my studies, I'm just gathered the wisdom of my studies and sharing it with you. But a true genius is somebody who studies stuff and sees things that nobody else saw, and extrapolates from the wisdom that he received ideas that nobody else would have noticed, and comes up with something completely new. And so he calls it Likutei Amarim, a gathering of sayings, I think out of humility, really. But also seeing himself as a conduit for wisdom that he received. And it's called Likutei Amarim, specifically. Amarim means sayings, from the word amar, to say, amira. Because, as we'll see in his introduction, he actually gathered these teachings from his conversations that he had with people. He was a spiritual guide. He was a person that thousands of people came to with their spiritual questions. And they sought his guidance. And he was able to advise people in their lives and inspire people and direct them in the right way. And when you get a name for that, more people come to you. And so he was extremely busy with giving advice and inspiring and guidance, to the point where he couldn't keep up with it anymore. And he made a very strict regime of who can come to him and when. And people were only allowed to come once a year, and had to come with certain preparations and rules, because he couldn't handle all the people coming to him. And even that ended up being too hard for him to keep up with. And so what he said in his introduction is, I'm going to gather all the answers to all the questions and put it in book form. So you don't need to come and ask me anymore. You just need to open the book and you'll get the answer.
It's a compilation of his teachings, of nobody else's.
Well, he's still saying it's a compilation of the wisdom that he received, which we'll see in the next lines, that he has verbalized, that he has taught to people. But he says in the introduction later, I just don't have time to meet everybody and to share this wisdom that I received. So I'm putting it in a book, so all the answers are there. Now, in all humility, to be able to say that about a book is quite astounding. He's saying all the answers are there. Like all the questions that people ask about life and their spiritual direction and what their mission is and how to handle their inner struggles, all the things that people came to him for, he's putting it all in a book that'll all be available.
And what does he say about if people still have questions afterward? He sort of empowers the elders to...
So there he says that if you look in a book and you can't find the answer, go to the wise people in your community and ask them to explain it to you, because it's there. And he says to them, to the wise people of the community, that they should not be humble and say, oh, who am I to say? No, you teach. If you know, then you teach. You have to teach what it says. And that instruction that he gave in his introduction has become a bit of a call to action for the couple of hundred years since then, that anyone who asks you to teach Tanya, you have to say yes. In this case, Guy was the one who asked, and thanks for hosting us and making it happen. So I didn't tell him then, but I'm telling you now that you can't say no to that request. Why not? Because the Alter Rebbe himself wrote in his introduction that if you've learnt Tanya, you have to teach it. And if somebody asks, don't be humble and say, well, who am I to teach? You have to teach it, because it's got the answers there. The answers are there. So we're already setting a very high bar here. We're saying that, like, you've got questions? Yeah, I've got questions. We've all got questions. We've all got things that baffle us about life, about ourselves, about our relationships, about our place in the world, what's going on in the world. We've got a lot of questions. These are the questions. If we would have access to someone like the Alter Rebbe, we would ask them. I mean, imagine the list of questions we would ask somebody who has prophetic vision, who is an incredible scholar, who has a deep understanding of human nature and people and the soul and other worlds and high worlds and the divine purpose. If we had access to such a person, we'd have serious questions that we'd want to ask them. The Alter Rebbe is saying, ask and look in Tanya and you'll find. You'll find the answers there. So that's the Likutei Amarim. It's a gathering. It's a collection of conversations that he's had that will cover everything.
Has there been like other books, commentaries on Tanya?
Yeah, many.
Other people?
Many. Sort of, okay. Many, many. Yep. So Likutei Amarim is the name of the book in general, but it continues, Chelek Rishon, the first part of this book, Hanikra B'Shem Sefer Shel Beinanim, is called Sefer Shel Beinanim, literally the Book of Intermediates. The book that we call Tanya, and he's called the Likutei Amarim, has four or five parts to it. The first, most famous and fundamental part is what we're going to study, which is called Sefer Shel Beinanim, which means the Book of Intermediates. And this already also gives a bit of an insight into what we're talking about. Not to jump the gun, because really it's explained in the later chapters of Tanya, but it's important just to give a bit of an insight. What Tanya really tries to address is, I guess, an open secret that we all have. And that is that we feel quite two-faced. That every one of us, and assuming including all of us and anybody that we know, we generally want to be a good person. We want to do the right thing. Yes, of course there are exceptions, but present company at least. We're all decent people who want to do the right thing, want to be nice, want to be good, want to be kind, want to be patient, want to interact correctly and nicely with the people around us. We want to respond correctly even when things may annoy us or go the wrong way. We want to have a good character and do the right thing, and we want to fulfill our mission here in this world to do mitzvahs, to do good deeds, and to be the person that we're supposed to be. We all want that, but we don't always do it. Like somehow we fall and fail and make bad choices and respond incorrectly and impulsively sometimes, say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing, think the wrong thing, feel bad things. We, on all levels of our personality, we don't get it right all the time. And some more than others, but we all, if we're honest, we fail and make mistakes. Not only that, but sometimes we do things that are downright immoral, quite ugly, wrong. And we know they're wrong, and we regret it afterwards, but we still did it. We fell for it, whether it was temptation or impulse or just a bad decision. We do the wrong thing all the time. And this is nice people, good people. And if we're honest with ourselves, we look and we say, here I am, at whatever age I am, I'm supposed to be a mature person, I'm supposed to be developed to some level, and I've been trying, and I still fall, and I still fail. And not only that, but there's a part of me that sometimes wants to do a bad thing, and wants to do something wrong, and allows myself to do it. Even if I know it's wrong, or I justify that it isn't wrong. Who am I? What type of person actually am I? There is, on the one hand, a bit of an expectation, and certainly for somebody who studies Torah, an expectation that you will do the right thing. We've got all these commandments, all these mitzvahs, to love your fellow as yourself, and to be honest in your dealings, and to honor your parents, and to treat every person as the image of God. There's certain high expectations of us. And somebody who studies the Torah and tries to keep it has a standard that is expected of them. And if you believe it, you believe this is from God, so this is important stuff. And yet, we don't always do it. We don't always keep it. Sometimes we don't even want to. Who am I? Am I a good person or not? Am I a righteous person or not? I can sit in shul and daven, say the prayers, Shema Yisrael, and praising God, and singing, and doing all this stuff. 5 minutes later, or 5 minutes before that, if you see me, I'm not so angelic. The way I spoke to somebody on the street, or somebody in my home, what I was thinking, even when I was in shul, if you could read my mind, thank God, nobody we know can do that. But if you could read what was going on through my mind in shul while I was davening, it's embarrassing. It's a disgrace. Who am I? Maybe nobody here relates to what I'm saying here and don't know what I'm talking about. It's possible this is just my problem. But I have a feeling that the Tanya was not just written for me. So this can be very depressing. Again, particularly for a person who strives to be a good person. There are people who are happy to just follow their whims and their urges and do whatever they want, and they don't have a standard, a moral standard. So for them, it's no big deal. I live how I like. I do what I want. What I want becomes the right thing. Okay. But for those of us who do have a moral standard, but we don't live up to it, at least not all the time. So who are we? Are we this holy person, or is that just an imposter? And we're actually this ugly, lowly person who can behave really badly. Who am I? Am I just two-faced? Hypocrite? What is actually going on?
I'm just human.
Yeah?
Like I was just thinking in the story of Adam and Eve, like going back to the beginning, there's always this struggle with temptation and other sort of forces.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's just a part of the natural struggle.
Right. So we need to see what is that struggle? What does it mean to be human? And what's acceptable and what's not acceptable in that struggle? Are we here to be perfect? Are we here to strive to perfection? It seems to be a Jewish value to try and be perfect. Perfectionism, I think, is something that does find its way into our families and into our attitudes. And it's probably not uniquely Jewish either. I'm sure there are other cultures who also strive for perfection. Is that what we're supposed to be? Are we supposed to be perfect? If yes, it's bad news, right? Right? Correct. So then we're not supposed to be perfect. So what are we supposed to be? All right. sometimes good, sometimes not? Like, is that acceptable? How does this work?
It is the strike that you are supposed to, as long as you aim mm-hmm. to be better than what you are, that's the idea, isn't it?
Okay, so to aim for it, even if you don't get there.
Yeah, to aim to be better, to mm-hmm. always look to be to learn.
Right. Because if you're striving for perfection and you never get there, that's actually going to lead to depression.
Yeah. But you want to strive to be better. You don't.
But to be better is different.
Yeah.
Correct. So what Tanya is going to introduce is the idea of a Beinoni. A Beinoni is somebody who he translates here as intermediate. Beinoni means an average, a middle person. Usually that term is understood as being half-half. There's a tzaddik, righteous person. There's a rasha, evil person. A Beinoni is in between. Bit of this, bit of that. Tanya introduces a different definition to a Beinoni. And what he's going to show us as we unravel the chapters of Tanya is that there's a person who is not a tzaddik. He doesn't reach perfection, and he never will. But it doesn't mean he's a rasha. It doesn't mean he's wicked and evil. You can be a person who strives for goodness without striving for perfection. Because what matters is what you do, not necessarily what you feel. If you do the right thing, even if you don't feel like it, or if you behave correctly, even though you're tempted not to, that's good. That's good. And that's in your hands. Your behavior is in your hands. Your feelings are not always in your hands. Your urges, you don't have so much control over. But fulfilling those urges, following them, you do have control over. And so you could be a person with very ugly temptations and urges and impulses, but you don't act on it. You do the right thing. And that is not a tzaddik. That's called a Beinoni. And we're gonna meet the Beinoni in great detail. What the Tanya says here on the title page is, this is the book for Beinonim. In other words, if you're a tzaddik, then you don't need this book. This is for people who struggle.
But I've been doing this a long time ago, and I thought Beinoni, even that, is like extremely high level.
We'll see, it is. It is a very demanding and high level.
Isn't it still depressing?
Well, no, because as we'll see, it's possible. It is possible. And there's always tshuva. Tshuva is what that means, you can fix whatever wrong you've done. But your responsibility is right now. Depressing is where there's an impossible dream. There's this, you know, this goal that you can never reach. But here it's, well, you can. Because let's say you did the wrong thing 5 minutes ago. Okay, so what do you do now? That you have a choice. What you do about it right now, you have total choice. Our mind tricks us and makes us feel bad about what's happened in the past, as if we can't fix it, in order for us to remain in that state and then just say, well, if I can't fix it, I might as well continue it. That's a trick of the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, to keep us bad, to keep us doing the wrong thing. But a Beinoni is somebody who says, okay, what happened 5 minutes ago happened 5 minutes ago. What do I do about it now? I have total choice. And I can redeem it. So the Beinoni is something that Tanya later says every single person can attain at every moment of their life. There is no point where you cannot be in control of your choices. And decide how to act, even if you can't decide how to feel all the time, or what to think all the time, but how to act you can. And this is getting ahead of ourselves, but it's what he's foreshadowing here by calling it the Sefer Shel Beinonim. They say that he wrote a book called Sefer Shel Tzadikim, a book for tzadikim, for the righteous, and that's a totally different level. But it's believed that book was lost in a fire, and never made it. No one saw it, which probably means that it wasn't so needed for the world, whereas this book was needed. Although they do say the author himself was a bit discouraged when he first wrote it. He felt that the only people who will read this are tzaddikim who don't need it, And the people who really do need it are not going to look at it. And his colleague said, don't worry, the tzaddikim need it. They do need it. And the people who need it will read it as well. It will reach everybody.
Did tzaddikim ever do tshuva?
It's an interesting question. Tshuva is a mitzvah. It's one of the mitzvahs to do tshuva.
Do they need to do tshuva?
So they do. So, but the word tshuva has many levels and meanings. The word tshuva really means to return. So, for somebody who sins, that means we've strayed from the path. To return means to come back to the path, to fix the evil that you've done. But there's a higher, deeper level of tshuva, and that is to return to your source. Even existing in the physical world is somewhat of a disconnection from your source, from the divine. Return means reconnecting to the divine, not being disconnected from God. So for a tzaddik, for a truly righteous person, tshuva means reconnecting your soul to its source, going above the mundane.
So, the question, what is the difference between Benoni and Tzadik? Because based on my understanding, Tzadik also has struggles, and the struggles define him as a Tzadik. So
we'll see. I don't want to foreshadow it too much because it's going to come in detail later in Tanya. But in brief, the difference between a tzaddik and a benoni is not in their behavior, but in their inner world. A tzaddik, the way Tanya defines it, is somebody who doesn't just not do evil, they have no interest or temptation or connection to evil. It doesn't interest them whatsoever. They have no relationship with doing evil. So they're not tempted whatsoever to do it. It's just not in their world. A benoni, it is very much in their world, and they're very tempted to do it, but they control themselves, and they don't do it. The Rambam uses the language a chassid or a moshel b'yitzro. There's a pious person, and there's somebody who controls their urges. A pious person means somebody who's above it, and a moshel b'yitzro, somebody who controls themselves, is somebody who's not above it, but they hold themselves back. So that, in essence, is how he differentiates between a tzaddik and a benoni, which means that his definition of a tzaddik is much higher than most people would think. Most people would define a tzaddik as someone who does the right thing. I'm sure they have urges sometimes to do the wrong thing, but they do the right thing. No, that's a benoni. A tzaddik is somebody who doesn't even tempted to do evil. In fact, the high level of tzaddik is somebody who is disgusted by the thought, put off by the even thought of doing evil.
Is that a developmental process of transitioning from a benoni to a tzaddik, like a muscle in some way?
Not really. It's a DNA. Yeah, it's something you're born with.
Yeah.
And that's what he says later, that there are certain souls who are sent into the world to be a tzaddik. It doesn't mean they didn't work hard. They have to work to get there and to maintain it. But their soul is made that way. Like it says Moshe, when Moshe was born, the whole room was full of light, you know, when Moses was born. He was just born. He didn't do anything.
Yeah.
His soul was so bright, it filled the whole room with light. You know, he was born circumcised, it says, about certain people. They already refined, already on that level. Some souls came into the world to be a tzaddik. That's their thing, that's their mission. But they're sprinkled through the generations. They're the small minority. The rest of us, that's just not our mission. That's not what we're here to do. We're not here to reach that level of perfection and righteousness. We're here to struggle, to fight a daily battle to do the right thing. And it never goes away. You get better at it. It becomes more refined. You win this battle and go to another battle. But it never ends. It's not like one day you just wake up and you're over it. It's fine. Whatever level you're on, the Yetzirah, the evil inclination, is going to come and try and pull you down. And you have to fight that and fight and fight and fight. And that's your mission. You shouldn't get depressed about that. I'm still struggling. Till the day you die. That's why the Talmud says, don't trust yourself till the day you die. Don't rest on your laurels and think, okay. You've got to be on guard at every moment. And that, Tanya will show us, that's not a consolation prize. That's not, well, you can't be a tzaddik, so I guess you'll just have to be the struggler and, you know, bad luck, that's your lot. No. God gets incredible pleasure from that, in some ways more than from a tzaddik. When a tzaddik does something righteous, it's not all that surprising. When a benini does, that's something. For a tzaddik to get up in the morning and say his prayers, it's like for us getting up and eating breakfast. Should we get credit that I'm hungry and I eat breakfast? Is that something I should be proud of? That's just nature. It's not an achievement. For a tzaddik, davening is the same thing. That's their taste. That's their urge. They get up in the morning, they need to daven. They need to do a mitzvah. They need to learn Torah. That's what they're interested in. Eat? Oh, they have to be reminded to eat. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got to eat as well. You know, the body can't survive without it. That's a tzaddik. So, is it such a big deal that they daven? Well, it is because it's a tzaddik davening, but for you and I to get up in the morning and to daven, to spend some time actually saying the prayers and trying to concentrate and putting on our tefillin, it's an achievement. That's something. Because we'd rather roll over in bed or do something else. Like, we've got all other things, distractions and urges, and we break ourselves to actually try to daven. That's something. The pleasure that gives Hashem, it's big. It's a big achievement. There's an energy there.
So is the goal to actually like suppress the Yetzer Hara completely, or is it good to have a little bit of, still feel like that tension?
Well, a tzaddik is somebody who has transformed the Yetzer Hara. Not suppressed it, but moved it around. Taken the urges, the physical urges, and moved them around to spiritual. So the Yetzer Hara is on side. The rest of us, suppressing is one part of it, controlling it, but it'll never go away. You know, you can beat it in this battle, but then it comes back in another battle, right? So, but it's controlling yourself. And Tanya will show us, the Yetzer Hara wants us to do this. The Yetzer Hara, what is it? It's an angel. It's an emissary of God. It's a part of us that God created with the mission to try and pull us down. That's its job. And our job is to not listen to it. So we're really on the same team.
So it seems like awareness is the goal. Mm-hmm. Sort of understanding it in real time to then have the choice.
Correct, because you need to identify.
Yeah.
Where is this voice coming from? What is this urge that is coming to me? Is it coming from a good place or a bad place? It's not always so obvious. Not every urge is obviously bad or obviously good. So to understand, where is it coming from? That's the training we need, and the awareness we need. Yep. So that's the Sefer Shel Beinanim. That is what this book is setting out for. So if this is where you're at, if you're a struggler, you're in. This is for you. This that's who the Alter Rebbe was speaking to. He continues that this book is compiled from sacred books and from teachers of heavenly saintliness. In Hebrew, Mulukan Mpisfarim Mpisofrim Kadosha Elyon Nishmasam Eden. That again, he says it's compiled from sacred books and from teachers. So he learned this from books from previous generations, as well as teachers that he lived with and studied with live. The tradition is that the books that he's referring to here are the books of the Maharal, a great philosopher of about 100 years before him, and the Maharal of Prague. He wrote many, many books. The Rambam, Maimonides, who lived 500 years, 600 years before him, as well as the writings of the Arizal, Rabbi Yitzhak Luria, from 200 years before him in the 1500s, the great Kabbalist, and his students. They are the main books, and the Shalah as well. There was a great Kabbalist, Rabbi Shaya Horowitz from Tzfat, in the late 1600s. It's said that these are the books that he based his teachings on. And the teachers are his direct teachers, the Maggid of Mezrich and the Baal Shem Tov before him. So, putting it historically, the Alter Rebbe, he lived in the 1700s, in the beginning of the mid 1700s. That's when he wrote this book in 1770. It was published, and so he was a student of Rabbi Dov Ber, known as the Maggid of Mezrich, who was the head student of the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement. So the Baal Shem Tov was the early 1700s, and he came about with this revivalist spiritual movement within the Jewish people at a time when they were in a spiritual low, it could be said. That there were two major catastrophes that happened in the years before the Baal Shem Tov to European Jewry. One of them was the Khmelnytsky massacres, that Bogdan Khmelnytsky, who was the head of the Cossacks in Poland, they went and slaughtered communities all over Europe. Till the Holocaust, this was like the biggest slaughter, really, that the European Jewry had seen. Hundreds of thousands of Jews and entire communities had been completely slaughtered. And there was a major collective depression after that terrible debacle. Another more spiritual malady that had hit the Jewish people was the false messiah, Shabtai Tzvi. This was also in the 1600s, that there was a Turkish Jew who was most likely mentally ill, but very talented and charismatic, believed that he was the Messiah. And he was a great scholar of mysticism, of Kabbalah, and presented a very, very convincing argument that he was Mashiach at a time that the Jewish people really needed it and wanted it. And he convinced many, many Jews, many people, and even leaders, great leaders, believed that he was for real. He believed it too. He was unwell. And to the point where entire communities sold their belongings and were buying tickets to Israel. The Dutch shipping companies were overridden with packages being sent to Israel of Jews who were moving to Israel at the time. It affected the world economy. It was like a major, major thing that was happening. He was arrested by the Turkish authorities as seen as being like some type of rebel. And while in jail in a place called Gallipoli, that we're familiar with, he converted to Islam, which didn't fit in to most prophecies about Mashiach. His followers insisted that this was actually exactly what should happen, that Mashiach is entering into the world of Yishmael and turning it around, and they explained it as being fitting into their theology. But the rest of the Jewish people were extremely disappointed, to say the least, and spiritually burnt. People like put their faith into somebody who abused their faith, and they actually started to lose their faith. This is such a big event. I mean, it's not our topic tonight, but it was so significant in Jewish history that really the assimilationist movements that came later only were really an offshoot of the spiritual disappointment that happened with this false Mashiach. It was only possible to have the enlightenment that came later and the assimilationists because of this abuse of faith. And what took the biggest hit was Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism. It was seen that this guy used mysticism as his basis, and he presented this false belief. So the Jewish people were spiritually and materially in a major down at this time. And the Baal Shem Tov appeared just at that time. And it said about him that his name was Israel, because he was like a wake-up call. You know, when somebody faints, you call their name. It was God sending a call to the Jewish people to wake up. Yisrael, wake up. And the Baal Shem Tov, he came with mystical teachings, using Kabbalah, but redeeming what had been abused, and with a pure faith and a positivity and a joy, and reviving the observance of Judaism in a spiritual way and in a way that's positive and happy. And his movement took the Jewish world by storm as well. There was a lot of suspicion because of the echoes of Shabtai Tzvi, which explains a lot of why the Hasidic movement faced a lot of opposition in the rabbinical leadership of the time. But that opposition was over time seen to be misplaced, because the Baal Shem Tov strengthened Judaism, didn't weaken it. But what's sometimes missed in the historical versions of the Baal Shem Tov story is he wasn't just like a populist or a nice storyteller who lifted the folk, the simple folk. He was an incredible deep scholar who brought a profound theology, an inspiring spiritual theology to the world that tried to find God in everything. The omnipresence of God, that God is everywhere and God is in everything, and that holiness can be found everywhere, and that spirituality is everywhere, and souls have missions to connect and to elevate. These ideas were very deep ideas. So it wasn't just the simple folk that he attracted, but also the great scholars that he inspired. So his great student was Rabbi Dov Ber of Mezrich, who crystallized and continued many of his teachings, who then had many students, one of which was Rabbi Shneur Zalman, the Alter Rebbe. The Alter Rebbe was the one who took the teachings of the Baal Shem Tov and the Maggid, and he distilled them into a cohesive philosophy. He was the first one to write in Tanya and in his other works, which he wrote many, a broad view of what the teachings of the previous generations were setting down. And so when he says he's compiling this from sacred books, it's those books, those mystical books that I mentioned, and philosophical books, and from teachers, his teachers, he's bringing it into an organized fashion. And he says that this book is based on a verse. And here, quite incredibly, he says, my whole book is based on one verse in the Torah. And that verse is, Ki korov elecha hadavar me'od beficha ovilvavcha lasoisoi. For this thing is very near to you, in your mouth and in your heart, that you may do it. This is from the book of Devarim, in Parshas Nitzavim. It says that this thing, talking about the mitzvahs, the commandments, serving God, is very near to you, in your mouth and in your heart, that you may do it. In brief, what that verse is saying is that, and this is right at the end of the Torah, 613 commandments, all these things that you have to do, all these expectations on you, this is the lifestyle you have to live, and this is how you have to lead your life, and you have to be, all these expectations, it's very near to you. Ki korav elecha, it's close to you, it's accessible to you. It sounds hard, it's not, it's totally accessible. That's what the Torah says. It's in your mouth and in your heart that you may do it. Which the Alter Rebbe explains, in your mouth is speech, in your heart is thought, and you may do it is action. There's thought, speech, and action. Thinking the right thing, doing the right thing, and saying the right thing. And all of that is close to you and possible for you to do. But explaining clearly how it is exceedingly near. What my book is to explain is that true? It's true that it's exceedingly near. Ki korav elecha hadavar me'od. It's very close to you. It's very accessible to be a righteous person, to be a good person. How is this? How is very accessible? It seems to be a hard thing, not an easy thing. And yet the Torah says it's easy. I'm going to show you, says the Tanya, I'm going to show you how it's totally accessible. That you have the tools inside of you to do the right thing at any moment. You have a power inside of your soul to make the right choice right now, no matter what you're going through in your life, no matter what is surrounding you, or no matter what your experiences are, right now you can choose the right thing. It's your choice. And you have inside of you the power to do that. It's close to you. It's not something you need to attain from the outside. I'm going to show you, says the Alter Rebbe, how you've got it. You can do this. But he says, how am I going to explain it? So in the Hebrew, the last line is Lavar Hetev, to explain well, Echu Karav Ma'od, how it's close to you, how it's very close to you. Bederech Aruka Katsara, in a long and short way. A long and short way. What's a long and short way? Sounds a bit confusing. So the phrase comes from a Talmudic story. That there was a great sage, Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananiah was his name. Very sharp man. And he says that there was only one person who ever outsmarted me. And it was a little kid. He says, I was walking along the way, along the path. And I came to a fork in the road. And there was a little kid at the fork. And I said to the little kid, which way to the city? So the kid said, well, that's the short long way, and that's the long short way. So I went the short long way. That sounded, well, I went the short long way, so I went that way. And I walked, and it was straight to the city, but as soon as the city was right in front of me, there was thorns and bushes and blockages. I couldn't get to the city. So I came back to the fork, and the kid's still there, and I said, why'd you tell me that that's the short way? He said, I said, that's the short long way. This is the long short way. I said, why? It's short that way. You get right to the city, but it's long because when you get there, you can't get in. You're going to have to go around. This way is the long short way. It's a long path, but you get there. You actually get there. You're not blocked. You don't have to come back. It's long, but it's short. That's short, but it's long. This is long, but it's short. So Rabbi Shua said, that's the only person who ever outsmarted me. So the Alter Rebbe borrows that phrase, and he says, I'm going to give you the long, short way. What does he mean? That there are many books out there, self-help books, that give you life hacks. I don't know if they'll call that in the 1770s, but that's what we call them today. What's a life hack? A quick fix. I'll tell you the one thing you need to do. Do this every day, and you'll solve all your problems, and everything will be good. You'll fix everything. All you need to do is a cold shower, you know, or moving your eyeballs in certain ways, or eat this ginger, whatever. Like there's all these amazing things, and they all have value and everything. But I think we all know that anyone who tells you that there's one easy, simple, cheap thing to do and it'll fix all your problems, we know that's not true. Like, it can't be. It may be helpful. It may do something, but it's not going to fix all your problems. We all know that to actually really be physically healthy takes more than a pill or a little stretch. Like, it takes work. And to be spiritually healthy is exactly the same thing. That There are quick paths, and then there are long paths. The quick paths are quick, but they're long in the end. A quick fix, but you don't actually get there. You're gonna find blockage on the way. It'll feel good for a little bit, but then it won't actually solve the problem. But then there's long short ways. Long, because it takes effort, and time, and consistency, and you're gonna have to work. But it's short because you get there, you actually get there. And this, the Alter Rebbe is offering us, the short, long way. Stick with this, go through it, apply it, do the hard work, and you'll get there. Which seems a bit of a contradiction to what he said a line above it. A line above it says, "Hikarav alecha davar me'od." It's very close to you. And now he's saying, it's a long, hard path. Which is it? Is it very close, sounding like quite easy, or is it a long, hard effort? How can it be both?
That's the contradiction. Depends on yourself. Like, it can be close, but you're struggling, so that makes a long way. But it's close. You're still. Like when they say, I don't know what source for it, but when the neshama leaves the body and they show the neshama the Yetzer Hara, if it's tzaddik, they show him a massive mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, look, this is what you overcome. And if it's a rasha, they show him a little mountain and say, look, this is the Yetzer Hara, this is what you couldn't manage.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So it's both, yeah? It's easy, but it's...
Yeah, I think the point that it's close to you doesn't mean that it's easy to reach and to touch. You might still have to circle it 200 times before you can actually touch it. It might burn you if you touch it straight away. So this, mm-hmm. it still might take a long process to actually to come to tell you what you need to do. So it might be very close to you in your mouth, in your heart, and the rest of it, but it still doesn't mean that you can actually...
Right.
I think the just to build on that, I think the integrated nature of having the long way and the short way together is a profound sort of understanding of human nature, sort of sprinkle the quick wins to keep moving, but those are just really motivation to keep going along the longer path, because if it was purely just the longer path, I think a lot of people would give up.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the need for the integrated nature and having both of them together in a hybrid fashion allow for the long to be achieved,
mm-hmm.
in the end.
Right, right. So when he says ki karav elecha adav ma'od, it's very close to you, that doesn't mean that it's an easy thing to achieve. What it means is you've got the power to do it. If I were to tell you that you want to do a 20k run, like, you can do it. I know that you have the power to do it. That doesn't mean it's easy to do. It's going to take work to work yourself up to it, but I see in you, you've got the power to do it. So, meaning you don't need to somehow get somebody else's legs. It's your legs. You have your heart. You can do it. You've got the power inside of you to do it. But you want to do it? So let's get to work. Like, there's going to be a slow and steady path to get there. But knowing that you have the power to do that is already half the battle, the psychological battle. Right? Because when you think, oh, it's not for me, I can't do this. So you're right. No, you can't. Once you've said that, you can't do it. He says, no, you can. You have an incredible soul. You have incredible powers inside of you. You're given the exact challenges that are for your soul. If your life is difficult, that's because you have an incredible soul to overcome those particular difficulties. If you've got a lot of challenges, that's because you've got amazing power inside of you. And so it's close to you. You've got the power. It's inside of you. It's invested in you already. That's already there. You need to tap into that. You need to learn how to tap into your own soul power. And then it's going to be a long path, meaning you're going to have to work. And the Benini's job is never over. It's not correct. It's not even so much about the destination. It's about that constant winning today's battle. You won the battle today, amazing. And there'll be another one tomorrow or tonight. So it's both exceedingly near to you, and it's a long short path. That's how we're going to get there. And he ends it with the words Be'ezras Hashem Yisbarach, with the aid of the Holy One, blessed be He. Which you could see as just like a technical, you know, Be'ezrat Hashem, you know, like people say, with God's help. You know, at the beginning of the book, it's with God's help. But the fact that the author, in these few words, is summarizing his book, I think it's saying more than that. It's saying, don't forget who put you here. Who put you in this situation? How did you get here? You didn't just appear. This is not by accident. Hashem put you in this world, in this life, in this body, with this personality, in this character, and these neighbors, and this particular financial situation, and these relatives, and this issue that you're going through. Like, all that was from Hashem, who gave you also your particular soul with your mind and heart and its powers and your education and exposures and abilities. It's all from Hashem. So if we're here to be a good person and to bring light to the world, if that's our mission, and Hashem gave us that mission, it's the same God who gave us the obstacles to that mission and the difficulties towards that mission, both internal and external. It's all coming from the same place. So not only do we have the power to do it, but Hashem's there to help. Like, he's going to help us through this. He's given us everything we need. So it's all Be'ezus Hashem Yisbarach. It's all with the aid of the Holy One, blessed be He. Okay. That is the introduction, the first not even the first page yet of Tanya, the title page of Tanya. And in it sets the tone. And like I mentioned in his introduction, which comes after that, he sets out why he wrote this book. It seems he was quite reluctant to write it. And even after he wrote it, he was reluctant to publish it. Again, probably out of his humility, he felt, what am I adding? What am I actually bringing that's new? But the truth is that the Baal Shem Tov identified the Alter Rebbe as being a new soul, meaning that his soul had not been down in this world before. Most souls, almost all souls, are reincarnated. We're continuations of an old soul, but a soul that's been in this world and come back to finish unfinished business. The Kabbalists said, the Arizal said already 500 years ago, there are not very many new souls anymore. We're all down here finishing old stuff. We're continuing things that happened before. That's why we have deja vu all the time. And that's why we're always tired and exhausted. And we've been here so many times, done this before. That's why little kids are so clever these days. We've all been here before. We're continuations of previous lives. Every now and then, a new soul comes down. And that's the exception. A soul that hasn't been there before. A fresh soul. Why? They must have something revolutionary to bring the world. Something that's never seen before. A fresh new soul with a new perspective is coming down, not jaded by the past, like a completely original soul. The Baal Shem Tov, when the Alter Rebbe was born, said a new soul just came down who will illuminate the world with the light of Torah, both the revealed and the hidden Torah.
He said that when he was born.
And gave very exact instructions to his father as to how to raise him and how to bring him up. He had his hair cut at age 3 at the Baal Shem Tov, but he was told, don't tell him who I am. They just called him Zaidi, Grandpa. And he never saw the Baal Shem Tov other than that. And it seems the Baal Shem Tov wanted him to not be influenced by the Baal Shem Tov soul in a direct way. He was a student of his teachings, but he wanted him to do his path. And so why did this new soul come down? Because he's bringing something completely original to the world. And that the Tanya is his main work of sharing that. And he says in his book that even though books are not the same as hearing it live, that when you hear from a person talking, when it's alive, it penetrates you much more. Whereas reading in a book doesn't penetrate you the same way. You know, we learn, some people learn very well with, you know, visual, but audio, like words are not the same. And also they can be misinterpreted and they can be misunderstood, and you can't explain it the same way. However, I just don't have time to talk to everybody. And so he says that those who are seeking God, I'm talking to those who are seeking God, who are real seekers. If you're a true seeker, I'm writing for you. This book is for you. If you're seeking, then the answers will be here. And you just have to extrapolate the answers. And if you don't understand, ask somebody who does. That's the book we're going to learn. We are going to, please God, next week, go into chapter 1. We've done, there's more in the introduction, but I want to get right into it. So now we've set the tone, we'll launch into it. Good. Thank you.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Then what is the actual meaning of the letters? You know, like every Hebrew word's got, you can write it and you can. So I'm just trying to figure out, it's Ben, the name, or Ben?
Well, I think it's from the word Ben, meaning in between.
Yes.
So Benonim is a person, an in-between person, an in-betweener.
Okay.
That's how I would understand it. So it's making, it's personifying the word between.
Yeah.
I wonder what would have happened if the Alter Rebbe would have had a Yitro. And instead of writing, you would have 10s under him and 100s under him and 1,000s under him.
Well, he in a way did that. He did set up schools and he taught, and there were different levels of students. So he did have that to some extent, but I don't know if we would have Tanya then, if he did it that way. Like, in a way, you know, that would last for however it lasted, but we got the book.
Yeah. No, I'm just saying that went two different ways.
Mm. Yeah.
With the same problem. Mm-hmm. I haven't got time. I haven't got...
Right.
I can't do it all.
Right.
He chose this way, he chose that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Also there, that was talking about judging legal disputes.
Right. This is a bit different. Okay. That's a good point. Okay.
This is... For prophecy and for, you know, people would still go to Moses. Like, they weren't interested in going to the judges for their life direction, I think. So really, the Hasidim would say that learning Tanya is like having a yechidus, like having a private audience with the Alter Rebbe. Like you're sitting with him. Thanks.
I see Rabbi Moss, leave us on a cliffhanger.
It's just beginning.
I saw this, I don't know if it was in Grand Heights or not, but it looked like a Sefer Torah. But when they opened it, it had a contract, and then it had the signatures of 2,700 yeshiva people studying that this really, really rich guy had made a contract with each one of those 2,700s to look after the costs of them studying and living and so forth. And in exchange, he would get the same, how do you say, the blessings
for the Torah study.
Yeah. Insane.
It's a good deal.
Yeah, good deal. Not a cheap deal.
Yeah.
You mentioned the false messiah. He got caught by the Turkish, or the Turkish police, is that what it's happened?
Yeah, they arrested him.
So where did the false messiah come in? Like, at what point did it become... false messiah?
Well, before that, he proclaimed himself as messiah. He said that there's no need to fast on Tisha B'Av anymore, because I'm here.
And he had followers.
He had thousands of followers, and it spread throughout Europe.
What was the turning point that he went to jail? Like, I don't understand. How did it become that he became the false messiah?
Well, when he converted to Islam, that sort of gave it away. that was like... Right. For most people, that was the... I mean, for his hardcore followers, it wasn't, but for most people, that was the last straw, that, like, that doesn't really fit into...
It was one of the things he said, everyone now is the time to go to Israel. Is that why they put all
yeah.
this stuff on?
Yeah, they said, well, we're going. It's time. Yeah. Mashiach is here.
Was he the one who tried to perform a miracle and ended up doing himself? Or was that somebody else?
I don't think that was him. Don't believe so.
Chapter
3, yeah. There's a group in Turkey till today called
Sufism and Kabbalah.
That's sort of mysticism, you know.
Yeah.
But there's a group in Turkey today called the Donmer, who are the descendants of the Shabtai Tzvi followers. The Donmer, they're called. Yeah. Very mystical, hidden, you know, secretive group. Not, I think, quite ostracized as well. But they still believe.
So then they convert to Islam as well?
I think so. There's some form of Islam, but not really accepted by Islam, I believe. It's quite, you know. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's really put a put a strain on Jewish views on whether and when and if the Messiah will...
Till then, there were always Jews who left the fold, or you know what I mean, but there was never a movement of secular Jews. So, like, if you look at Jewish history, there were individuals who became more closer to the Romans or this or that, but very rarely did they reject Judaism completely. It was really only after that like Jewish faith like became shaken by many, and that sowed the seeds of assimilation that came later in Europe. It was a big blow, a spiritual blow.
Is it the Turekata also shaking themselves with the Jewish religion? And...
The Turekata?
Yeah.
The ones you're talking about they're just crazy. Like saying they're not shaking Jewish religion. They're just not in the realm of normal. But that's a small group of people who were not accepted even by their own. Even the Turekata. There's an official Turekata which rejects these guys who go and march with the
Romans.
Who?
The ones that are supporting the.
They're crazy.
The crazy lunatics.
Like, I was reading about the Satmars last year, about how they, like, they just don't want Jewish blood spilled, the Satmars, that's my understanding. Like, what did these guys believe? Like,
Satmar Israel, is an anti-Zionist Hasidic group who have maintained always from before the state and after the state that there shouldn't be a state of Israel until Mashiach comes, and so they oppose the idea of a state, but oppose it philosophically. There are many who live in Israel. They lived there before and they continue to live in Israel, but they don't participate. They don't vote. They don't take money from the government. They stay out of it. They just don't believe there should be such a state. That's a philosophy. You can agree or disagree, but that's what they believe. But they don't do anything actively to oppose, you know, to harm the state. On the contrary, now during this war, the Satmar yeshiva students have been cooking meals and sending them to the soldiers on the front, like anyone would. I'm saying, you know, philosophically they don't believe in a state of Israel, but they don't hate their fellow Jew. Like, there's, you know, Naturi Karta is a group that's also been around since the beginning of the state, that has more or less the same idea as that, but a little bit more extreme. They would protest a bit more and be a bit more active in their opposition to the state. But even then, it's only that far. The group that's on the news, it's a splinter of Naturi Karta. It's a group of maybe 20, 30 people. It's always the same guys. If you look, it's always the same people who are mentally unstable, who are just addicted to PR. And so they'll go and meet Ahmadinejad and Yasser Arafat. And they, over the years, it's been the same guys that have done the same thing. And they're very useful stooges for our enemies, because they look so Jewish. And here they are, so, you know. So, to explain their ideology, you can't. They're not.
They reckon it's all like 20 or 30 or 40 or something.
Yeah, it is. It is.
You see them so many times on the news.
But it's the same guys.
Yes, you think there's so many. But obviously,
yeah.
A lot of similarities make out as if that's all correct. People are like that.
Thank you. Yeah. Look. Unfortunately, there's a much stronger voice of secular anti-Zionists. In much more powerful positions that are a much bigger concern, but
absolutely,
they just don't look so, you know, photogenic. Like. Yeah, sure.
Personal
question. Sure. Every day? Um, Well, I think dealing with my kids, my Yetzirah is like everybody, is very egotistical, and kids are too, and they do what they want, and they don't do what I want. So I want to assert what I want, not what they want. Now, as a parent, there's the responsible asserting, you know, like guiding them and showing them the right path. That's being a parent. Or there's just like, I want to read my book now and you're disturbing me, so I get angry at you. That's the Yetzirah. That's a daily struggle to say, hang on a minute, this is my child who is being very reasonable at the moment. They want my attention. They want to ask me something. They're not doing anything wrong. I am being unreasonable, saying that it's my turn to read my book. That's not my time now. Like, so my Yetzirah tells me that I want to do my thing, and so I get annoyed at this kid who's doing what they're supposed to be doing. That's a daily struggle. Haven't been that one yet.
Yeah. On that point, like, yeah. So, you know, obviously kids cry a lot, and they like whinge all the time. It's like I'm trying more recently to like listen to them and make them feel heard and all of that. Mm. But yeah, like, is it okay to like say to them, like, you know, when you're crying like that, I can't actually hear what you're saying, or is that like kind of taken away from?
I think it depends how you say it, right? And it depends how they're crying as well,
yeah.
Right? Like, so if you're teaching them to regulate their own emotions as well, and like, you know, not to resort to that level of you know, of whinging an emotion, like, you know, you can say it calmly or whatever. That's
right.
If you're guiding them, right?
Yeah.
But if it's out of your annoyance or, you know, like, and they really need your sympathy, then not. It's a very, yeah. It's tricky to know where you know. But yeah, when you're more present in your responses, and you're not responding from your annoyance,
yeah.
Then you usually can get it right.
Yeah, I guess that when I'm doing it from my annoyance, then I'm like not wanting to actually listen to them. I'm just telling them stop whinging.
Right.
But if I'm saying stop whinging because I can't hear what you're saying, I want to hear what you're saying,
mm-hmm.
I can't hear you.
Right.
It's a bit better.
Yeah. 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 So come sit down, like, you know,
yeah.
when you calm down, I'll be able to hear it better, yeah, yeah. You know. So it's being like validating. Validating.
It's validating the emotions, it's validating what they feel, and then I feel.
Right.
Then you have to deal with what fear. But if it triggers you, then you're in the wrong place.
Yeah.
If you find that you're emotionally invested, then you. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, to feel empathy and like actually feel what they're going through, like be in their shoes a bit, you know. It's tricky. It's hard work.
There's also the opportunity to circle back at another time, and I think they feel validated when you could say, yesterday when you were like that, or, you know. So I don't think it's a complete missed opportunity if you pull back in the moment. But don't sweep it under the carpet. Try to
address
it in another
corner.
Yep.
It's a difficult one.
Mm-hmm.
What should you do? If you see your kids going down the wrong path, and then you can see it, say, yeah, it's a car, just heading the wrong direction, should you be stopping them? Or should you just, is it a lesson to learn sometimes?
Well, I think both, sometimes this, sometimes that, you know. There are certain mistakes that you have to let them make, right? We can't be these helicopter parents who stop, you know, save every mistake they make and stop every time they fall, you know, like that doesn't allow them to grow and to learn, and, you know. On the other hand, if they're like, you know, they're riding their bike onto the traffic, like you have to intervene, you know, like there are moments you do have to intervene, right? And sometimes, and it depends on the age, and it depends on, you know, what they're doing. You know, if they're actually endangering themselves in a direct way, you have to intervene immediately. If they're just making bad choices, you know, you have to be a voice that's there. And But again, what age are we talking about? You know, little kids, you got to, every step of the way, be directing them. As they grow, they've got to make some of their own mistakes. Can't control every friendship they have, and every, you know, conversation they have, and everywhere they go, and every fall, you know.
You can only give them a set of tools and hope that they have their own conscience in place. And own. So I've got 4 kids, 2 older ones who just marriage and 2 younger ones. And the 2 older ones are always lovey-dovey and they're allowed to do everything. And, you know, I could always pick them up and I would always be there for them and everything. And they turned up bad, like literally like bad adults. And the young ones are a lot more strict with them, and you know, I've got a lot of conflicts with my wife, with my mother, but like I'm really quite adamant about it, I just say like, and kids do need boundaries, like all these lovey-dovey things today, and it, everything is acceptable, and everything is right, but at the same time, you know, like it's mind-boggling, like you never know what. Ask me in 20 years, I tell you, mm-hmm. we do that. Because I thought everything is going great with the younger ones, with the older ones as well, with the younger, but it's, and I think at the end of the day, the child, it's like a soul, they come up with a purpose, you know, and some of them need to learn the hard way and need to go through the awful path, and some, you know, like have easier, they just actually want to be good, they actually want to go in their parents' shoes, they want to go the path that the parents did and wants to, you know, for the parents to be proud, and some are just so rebellious from the day they're born. So, like even with my 2 young ones, we used to say that the older one, when he was born, it was all by the book. And like we used to have like one of those books, but and like week 1, week 2, week 3, you know, like literally by the book. And the second one came up with his own book. Nothing was that, and they're both awesome, like that really great souls and great intention, and they full of love. So, like, I think as a parent, there is a limit of what you can do, and some stage, just say, you know, at some stage, let them go and make their mistake and break their heads and, you know, and fall off their bikes and obviously not run into the road. That's my experience.
Yeah.
It's interesting that we moved from Tanya to education.
Right. It is. It's our child inside of us that we're trying to discipline.
Well, thank you, Guy.
Yeah, thanks for having us.